Brand new week. We kicked it off on Monday, April 20th on Connecticut Today with our daily coverage of the coronavirus situation. We talked to an education expert from Southern Connecticut State University on whether or not kids from K all the way up through college are really learning anything if they're learning online at home. Political strategist and pundit Tom Basile joined us again to look at the political overtones of the coronavirus mess. And we carried Governor Ned Lamont's daily coronavirus media update. All this, for lack of a better term, homeschooling that's going on. All of a sudden, the school years for students all the way from kindergarten through high school and college as well. Disturbed, overturned, in limbo. I don't know how else you could put it. Joining us right now is an associate professor of educational leadership and policy studies, Professor Sausan Arafa from Southern Connecticut State University in New Haven. Professor, thanks for joining us today. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Did you ever think in your wildest dreams, as an educator and as a professor who deals with this, that millions and millions of students, without an act of war or mass terrorism, would be at home trying to do what they do, looking at a computer screen?
Well, I think that if one thinks about the future in a long distance away, that we could have maybe imagined that this would be a scenario. But in terms of how quickly it happened and how quickly we all had to move and jump to accommodate, absolutely not. This has been a real shock.
Did that surprise you? It kind of surprised me as to how relatively quickly being a relative term, Professor, but how quickly we kind of got this going. I know there are still some holes with some kids in some areas, inner cities, who don't have laptops. But one thing I am impressed with is the fact that using all the tools we have, we kind of ramped this thing up pretty quickly.
I would say that's the case, and I would congratulate all of our IT professionals, of our internet providers, and certainly the teachers, the administrators, and the parents, the students themselves. Everybody has stepped to overall and done a great job of it. I mean, it's been really remarkable.
And the college field where you are, many colleges now, 10, 15 years ago, online learning, what do you mean? No, you've got to be in the classroom. I think, Professor, the colleges have kind of really done a lot of the early grunt work on this.
That's true. And, for some time, there have been many institutions and many courses within institutions that have been teaching online for some time. Many of us now, we teach hybrid, half and half online and face-to-face, which is a wonderful way to do that. And in fact, in terms of the research, they've shown that hybrid learning like that, having some components that are online and some face-to-face, is really, really effective. And what's new now about the online learning is that with the video conferencing that's possible, now we're able to online have some of those face-to-face components, which really make this, quote, online education so much more interpersonal. The colleges have really stepped up. And, what will be interesting to see is what will happen in the future. How will this change the way that education is done and the way that we perceive learning?
Why do you think the combination, Professor, has worked? You say that research shows the mixture of both works well. Why do you think that is?
I think that it has to do with different people's learning styles. Some of us are introverts, some of us are extroverts, some of us are ambiverts, some of us enjoy looking at graphical information, some of us like looking at text, some of us like to listen to things through our ears. And so I believe that the hybrid, the online and the face-to-face component allows students and teachers to use more of their learning styles. And so there are those people who, really they'd rather read something and digest it on their own, not with a lot of chatter in class, think about it, and maybe type in on a discussion board, their thoughts. There are others who, might want to put together some kind of neat PowerPoint presentation or some kind of multimedia presentation of their thoughts. And so I think it just offers an opportunity for us to learn in multiple modes. And I think it's a real benefit because, for example, I know that many of my students who will not speak up in class and really are, I don't know, whether they're afraid to share their ideas or they would prefer not to share them openly amongst a whole group of people, they are so articulate and, engaged in an online space on a discussion board. For example.
And it provides
a lot of opportunity.
Yeah, and you probably see how articulate they are, right? And, Professor, you probably go, wow, where'd that come from, right?
Well, yeah, sometimes that's the case, sure.
We continue a few more minutes with a guest again on education. This is fascinating what has happened to the U.S. education system from K right on up through college. Dr. Sausan Arafat, she's an assistant professor of educational leadership and policy studies at Southern Connecticut State University in New Haven. Doctor, what are you hearing? Maybe I know it's way too early for real studies here. Anecdotally, from people you know in the teaching profession at various levels or your colleagues, are you hearing anything about how this is going? Anything yet or not?
Oh, absolutely. Everybody's talking about how it's going. And I would say that it's going well. And despite the fact that a lot of people are very, very overwhelmed, and, as you know, it's really kind of blindsided us, people are managing, and people are actually at a point, I think that we're getting to a tipping point, where people are beginning to feel confident that they are able to put things together, that they're able to educate online, and that they're able to communicate with students and parents and with each other in ways that are important to ensure that learning persists. So I think that we're doing pretty well. And I know that there are different people who feel that they would prefer, to have face-to-face education. But there are some who are saying, I'm really enjoying this online experience, and it's going to change the way that I think about educating and the way I teach, perhaps.
The evaluative things we do, the SATs, the mastery tests, this and the other, we just put those on hold for a year or so. How do we attack those issues?
That is a thorny issue, and I have to say I'm not exactly sure how we attack those issues. The tests are there because they are mandated by states, by the federal government. You have classroom-based assessments that teachers use to make their own assessments about student progress. But in terms of the formalized tests, I'm not exactly sure how that's going to go, and it'll be very interesting and important both to keep, track of the trajectory of what's happening, but also to feed into that and to provide input about whether and how the assessments are important as they were, or whether we need to modify them for the future. I mean, certainly they're going to need to be modified for students who have not been able to, adequately or, fully complete all of the learning that they were supposed to be doing across this school year.
As we look at this school year, which is fractured, there may be a week or two to get students back, although I doubt it. What happens, Doctor, with the students that we're looking at from, the early grades on up through college? Obviously, I don't think it's practical to have everyone finish out a half year, then start again. Or is it? I don't know. Do we just promote everyone? Challenges in that area? What are they?
Well, I think the challenge is, again, it's a formalized challenge that has to do with policy around, what constitutes an appropriate level of education, and do we pass people on? I think those questions are being discussed and considered at government levels and within the schools and within the districts. People are trying to figure out, sort of what will happen and how it will go. As teachers and professors, those are policy issues that impact us, and that we, if we feel that we need to have input into them, we should. But that we should really be focusing at the moment on just trying to connect with our students, keeping ourselves calm and grounded and focused on excellence in our profession and in the education that we are providing our students, and just supporting our students in learning. And I want to say also that when we focus so much on what's happening with, the formalized aspects of school, what we're missing is the really huge opportunity that is happening now, where we are all learning things that we never thought we needed to know. We're learning in new modes. We're learning in new ways. So we're all doing a lot of other types of learning that we may not have valued in our, traditional academic sense and the way that we've pursued school. And that's something to really consider. What are we learning now, and how will that feed into what we know and do in the future? I'm looking at students who, because of this experience, they are changing their orientation to learning. Mm-hmm. They may have thought, I don't like school, I don't need school, but I'm hearing things that, school is really interesting to me all of a sudden, and in fact, I'm doing very well with this online approach. So, in terms of the formalized grades and assessments, passing people on, I really have no clear sense of how that should go. But in terms of the fact that people are learning, I do believe that they are in many ways, and in many ways that we don't even know.
Finally, a lot of people they say they're scratching their heads. Well, geez, it's already April 20th. Why is Governor Lamont and the State Education Commissioner, Dr. Cardona, why are they holding out now May 20th as a startup date? Why don't they just call it quits on the whole school year? I had another expert in this field a few days ago on the show, Doctor, and she thought it was important to at least, even if it's only for a few days, to bring the students back for a sense of renewal and closure, even if it's, again, a half a week. What are your thoughts on that?
I agree, because school is not only about the academics. School is also about, social interaction. It's about friendships and relationships. And we have lost, while we've lost academic time, what I think we've lost more is our connections to our colleagues, to our teachers, to our friends. And all of that has made it, difficult to feel grounded. People are making those relationships up in new ways now. I mean, one of the things that I would encourage students to do that they haven't done in the past is really connect with your teacher when they have office hours and just take a moment to connect with them. That kind of interpersonal connection is really important. And so I would agree with my colleagues that, yes, we should have, if it's possible, even just a few days for people to get together, talk about their experience, and talk about their hopes for the future.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating stuff. Dr. Sausan Arafe, PhD, Assistant Professor, Southern Connecticut State University, Educational Leadership and Policy Studies. Doctor, thanks for taking the time. We know you're busy. We appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Happy to welcome back Tom Basile. He's been on the show here a few times. Noted author, columnist, speaker, commentator, political pundit. You see him and see his columns, too, at Newsmax.com. His latest book, Let It Sink In, The Decade of Obama and Trump. We should mention Tom also a professor at Fordham University, because the political angle of this is starting to, Tom, you think it's starting to germinate a little more here of what's going on with the coronavirus. We've had a good month or so of the epidemiological angle of this, Tom. Now I think we're seeing a little more of the bare-knuckle politics here.
Yeah, I think you're going to see certainly a lot more of that as this continues. I had a column on Fox on Newsmax.com, mm-hmm. A couple of weeks ago, about some of the things that I continue to start to see take shape here. And it's something that's very concerning, frankly, because I think you're hearing from a lot of Democrats that in being parroted in the media that the coronavirus should necessitate significant changes to the way that we conduct our voting in this country. And I think that people need to be very, very careful about particularly Democrats trying to change the way we conduct our elections because of coronavirus, whether it's whether it's repealing voter ID laws, universal mail-in voting, wearing masks in polling places, expanding early voting, and providing what they would say is providing assistance for vulnerable populations, but that's generally known as the corrupt practice of vote harvesting that we see in California. So people need to understand that there's a line and a message that's being delivered here by the Democratic Party that using the virus as an excuse that's very troubling.
And again, it's not, Tom, I've always said this on the program and in stuff I've written too, it's not that changes or updates to how we vote should not be considered, but those should be debated long and hard at the federal level. The state level, a lot of people don't realize, states run elections, not the federal government.
Right.
You can't do that in a 5 or 6 month compressed time frame.
You can, and I think that the suggestion by people, by certain people at the state level and the federal level, that we need to leverage this crisis to advance these types of reforms. I think that's very suspect. They're doing it for political purposes, and we need to do everything we can to protect the integrity of our election system. And, frankly, Paul, you're right. I think that the Democrats who are driving this message and the media that are driving this message realize that most of these types of reforms in most places are not going to happen in time for the November election. And I think that sets up Democratic Party leaders to say that should Trump win, that it's not a legitimate win. That fear kept people away from the polls, fear of the virus, and therefore, just like they did in 2016, where they tried to delegitimize the election, they will try and use the pandemic to do the same thing in 2020.
Tom Basile is the guest. Check out his website, Tom Basile. That's TOMBASILE .com. Tom, I have discussions about this here on the show with my liberal-leaning friends, and they say, well, we already have absentee ballots. Well, Bridgeport, Connecticut, you want to talk about absentee ballots, you can do that. But there's a big difference, Tom, between absentee ballots and ballots for those who are out of the country or unable to vote versus trying to secure, 130 million ballots, 140 million ballots?
Right.
I don't even know, Tom, how you do that. Do you bring in the National Guard? Do you use federal and state marshals to watch the harvesting of these ballots? How the heck do you do that?
There is no infrastructure to do it. And I'm certainly not going to turn the fate of any election over to the Postal Workers Union and the folks who manage the mail. I've been involved in politics a long time, and I know that when it comes to political mail, strange things happen in the mail. Mailers don't get mailed on time. They don't arrive in time. Things arrive after the election. Things are postmarked after they should be postmarked. There's a lot of funny business that can go on with the mail. And I'm somebody who, and I agree with you, Paul, I'm like, I think that we should always be looking at ways that we can improve. We can improve our public policy. I'm a big fan of no excuse voting. I don't think it's the governor's no excuse absentee voting. I don't think it's the government's business to judge whether or not I have a valid excuse. If I want to vote and I have to work that day in Manhattan and I can't get to the polls, that's my business, right? So I'm a big believer in that. I think that more states should do that. But there's a lot of daylight between that and something like voter harvesting, where another individual actually can help manage your ballot and your process of submitting your ballot, which is what goes on in the state of California. And it's absolutely terrifying. You'll see. You'll talk to people out there about how that has really corrupted the system. Particularly, it's enabled activists to prey on seniors, people who are in group homes, people who have developmental disabilities, who they have somebody who kind of takes control of the voting process for that person. So we have to be very, very careful about this. And again, I think that it's uncomfortable to think about it this way, but I don't put anything past the Democratic Party leadership that we currently have in this country to use this as an excuse to, again, try to cast doubt on the integrity and the legitimacy of our election system.
And Tom, I'm also one of the things I think maybe you look at, maybe you go to 2 days of voting, Monday, you know, Tuesday and Wednesday of election week, or you vote on weekends. The one that makes me laugh, though, Tom, is I'm not opposed to early voting by, you know, if we can take the burden off the polling places by a day or two or three, because let's face it, you and I both know that a lot of people, by the 3 or 4 days before the election, you know, there's still some undecideds, but most people have made up their minds. Most scandals aren't going to break, you know, 3 days before. But, Tom, did I just see somebody, I think it was Virginia, forgive me if I'm wrong, but some state just went to 45 days of early voting. And I had a friend of mine, I had a friend of mine, Tom, who said, well, that's great. I said, well, no, wait a minute. What if you go vote 40 days out, and no matter who you're voting for, left or right, suddenly your candidate is found with, I don't know, funny money, child porn, there's an allegation of a sexual assault. Your vote is gone because you voted 40 days early.
Well, not only is your vote gone, what's really more insidious about it, and I agree with you, I think it should be election day, not election month. And especially with the conveniences that we have today, and I'm all for being flexible. But what's even more insidious about it is that let's say something happens to the candidate. Under state law, you can't get the candidate off the ballot.
Yeah.
So what happens then? Your vote, not only does it go away, but in certain instances, it could lead to a repeat election, or you end up putting the ability to fill that seat, and this doesn't happen for president, of course, but it can happen for down ballot races, into the hands of an appointing authority, either within the political party or you know, elected officials. And again, that takes the power away from the people and gives it to elites, and that's not the way that we're supposed to be handling choosing our leaders in this country.
A few more minutes with Tom Basile, TOMBASILE, TomBasile.com. He reads his columns at Newsmax.com. His latest book, Let It Sink In, The Decade of Obama and Trump. Former member of the Bush White House team, a noted political pundit. You see him everywhere and anywhere. Tom, the coming election, you know, I watch Joe Biden's appearances. And look, you can have policy differences with the guy, but he was a two-term vice president, numerous decades in the Senate, was considered at one time one of the most whip-smart guys or gals on Capitol Hill, real operator here. But Tom, I got to tell you, I cringe when I watch him now. And let me ask you this. Are the Democrats saying, well, maybe it's 1996 and Bob Dole all over again? Should we just throw a pitch up there and see what happens? Is that what they're thinking?
I think that Biden, there's a general consensus that is forming within the Democratic Party that Biden is fairly weak. He's got, he's a last man standing candidate. This is not somebody who won a hard-charging, hard-fought primary, who's got a lot of passion behind him, who's leading a movement like Donald Trump is leading a movement, whether you like Donald Trump or not. Yeah. He generates an enormous amount of enthusiasm around himself and his campaign and his ideas. So I think that consensus is starting to form around Biden, and frankly, you're absolutely right. And this is a guy back during the 80s and 90s who was known for not only being really sharp, but for being a centrist, for being a common sense kind of guy. I mean, he was the best man in Al D'Amato's wedding. This is somebody who used to get along with Republicans, and now he seems to be entirely controlled by the left flank of his party. And he's weak now, and there's a level of – there's a gap of enthusiasm deficit between Democrats and Republicans. And that's before the president has spent any of his war chest really talking about the Joe Biden of today.
Yeah.
The gaffes and the incoherent speeches and interviews aside, this is a guy who now believes in taxpayer-funded abortion. He believes that in sanctuary cities, that in decriminalizing illegal border crossings, in the AOC-supported Green New Deal, in the Elizabeth Warren so-called, you know, free college, free debt relief entitlement program. It's not going to help people in the Connecticut, New York, New Jersey area because of the way that it's set up. And somebody who has repeatedly talked about trying to make healthcare more affordable and not only has failed over and over, but has outright lied to the American people about that time and time again. And so people haven't even gotten that message yet from the Trump team. And yet there seems to be this lack of this real lack of passion and enthusiasm for the Biden candidacy.
So let me ask you then to prognosticate, if you can, who will his vice president pick be? Because, and I know, Tom, we always say it, it's a heartbeat away from the presidency. Well, Biden himself has said he'd probably be a one-term president, you know, being inaugurated at 78. Who knows what his state of mind will be in a year or two. So who does he go with for a number two on that ticket?
Well, first of all, he boxed himself in. Because he said that he was going to play the identity politics game, yeah, and he was going to have a woman. So now you have to look at the women. He's doing a podcast today with Amy Klobuchar, and you know she did fairly well during the primary. So there's some speculation that it was going to be her. Governor Whitmer of Michigan was on the short list, I think, up until last week when she decided she would tell everybody that they could buy their booze in their pot, but they couldn't buy tomato plants and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So he doesn't have a lot of places to go. And you know, it's interesting, the divide between Democrats and Republicans on the issue of choosing running mates, because, you know, by and large, Republicans they still select their running mates based on that number one criteria. Who could be, who has the requisite experience and gravitas to be the president of the United States. Now, let's look, you know, maybe Sarah Palin was an outlier. But, you know, I was on the Bush campaign in 2000, and people were throwing all sorts of names around that had some sort of political or ethnic or geographic sort of hook. And, you know, and Bush chose Cheney. Trump chose a governor, somebody who has demonstrated, particularly during this crisis, this enormous capability. I don't know. I think that maybe Klobuchar is probably close to the top of the list at this point for him.
Yeah, because maybe she gets him some of those white, blue-collar, middle-class rust belters, Tom, that the president won enough of to maybe wrestle it away from him. Yeah, to me, she would make sense. We'll have to see his website. Check him out. Tom Basile, TOMBASILE.com. Read his pieces at FoxNews.com and Newsmax. His latest book, Let It Sink In, The Decade of Obama and Trump. Tom, good wishes to you from the People's Republic of Connecticut. Stay safe there in New York City, and we'll be in touch. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you, Paul. Great to be
Thanks.
With you.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Quick daily summary on COVID-19. These numbers are bouncing around a little bit, and I just ought to tell you, when you see 1,853 positive cases, you go, my God, that's an awful lot. Or 204 fatalities, that's an awful lot. What's going on? In this case, the CDC changed their definition in the last few days of both a positive case and somebody who dies of complications related to COVID, or if somebody had COVID-like symptoms and passed away. So we're just truing this up so we keep with the CDC and federal definitions, so you know where we are on a nationwide basis. You know me, the other interesting number in terms of direction is hospitalization. You know, over the weekend, we went down, and that hasn't happened 2 days in a row in, you know, since the start of the crisis. This time we went up a little bit, but you'll see as we go forward, the trend line is still down. Hartford, you can, the top line is Fairfield. You can see there we definitely have bent the curve on the way down, hit the apex. I think we feel fairly confident about that. We're maybe 10 days behind New York City, a week behind New York City. Next line there is New Haven. They're maybe 10 days or so behind Fairfield County. That line is flattening out. You see, we have good capacity in those hospitals, and they're able to help out Hartford a little bit. The blue line at the bottom, Hartford is still picking up, and that created you know, small increase overall in our hospitalizations. This chart, again, hospitalizations is the lead metric we can tell for how we're doing, but I'm going to give you some new metrics in a few minutes. But the three-day moving average is down. That is good news. That says that we have good capacity in our hospitals, and to the degree to which hospitalization tells us something about the overall infection rate, that's a good trend line. But we're not out of the woods. And I just wanted to put this chart on here to remind you that these countries were all 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 8 weeks in front of the United States in terms of getting hit with this pandemic. We could learn a lot from their responses, and we can also learn a lot from what they didn't do right. Each and every one of them thought that they had this crisis under control. They loosened up on their social distancing, and each and every one of them now has seen an increase in COVID-related infections again. So we're going to monitor this very carefully. What I really would like to do, if I could, is give you an idea of what more we can do as we prepare for our May 20th date. You know, every week now, every Thursday, you're going to hear from our Reopen Connecticut team. And what happens between now and May 20th that gives us more information that allows us to make the right decisions so we can slowly, on a phased basis, reopen our state and do that very safely? And hospitalizations is one way to tell how we're doing, but it's sort of a blunt instrument. And I'll tell you a few other things we're doing, including testing or over and above testing, to give us a better idea of how the state is doing, how we're bending the curve, and where we can start up. And first of all, I'd just like to tell you about howwefeel.org. How We Feel is created by an amazing MIT a neuroscience engineer, and a number of people in epidemiology and infectious diseases. And we're going to meet, you'll be able to meet him in just a few minutes. But right now with How We Feel, it's spread virally around the country in a computer science way, not an epidemic way. And what they've done is they're able to test different symptoms. You self-report on a voluntary basis symptoms, everything from a cough, fever, and the such. You get that posted. We have thousands of people here in the state of Connecticut using the howwefeel.org app right now. And I'd like to say that we are the first state to officially sanction How We Feel as an official partnership. How We Feel is going to take information from all over the state if more and more of you sign up for this app. It takes just a few minutes to put in your basic symptoms, and in turn, the leaders there, epidemiological, at How We Feel, will report back to the Department of Public Health here in our state and give us the best information they have in terms of what they see from these early symptoms going forward. More on that in a minute. Next, after the How We Feel app, we're doing a lot with thermometers. We've just got our first 3,500 smart thermometers. They're Bluetooth-enabled. You take the temperature of yourself and your family in the morning and in the evening. That, in turn, connects to your phone. That goes up to the cloud. So along with How We Feel, we're going to have a temperature map of what's going on in the state of Connecticut. We'll see where those symptoms maybe are moving a little bit. Maybe they're followed by fevers in a more official way. Tells us where the next potential hotspot should be or can be. I mean, right now we know that just through infections and hospitalizations, New York is down and Fairfield County is down, Hartford is up. We know that Boston is up right now, so we worry about what's coming in from the east at this point. And we look around the rest of the country that Louisiana is down, or more particularly New Orleans, but Chicago is up. But within our state, there are respective hotspots, and how we feel and our thermometers will allow us to test that. In addition, Josh has ordered tens of thousands of fever meters, a fever thermometer. And those are going to be incredibly helpful for us just to make sure that when you go into a manufacturing site, a Pratt & Whitney or Electric Boat or Sikorsky or any of the smaller manufacturing, anybody with a temperature more than 100.4, not allowed in. Doing this what we can to, in order to better protect you. And over time, we may find that we can open up our stores and retail and big box retailers a lot faster and sooner and more safely if we have that fever meter, just to test people on their way in and make sure you're not likely to be contagious. We had a good phone call today with Vice President Pence's task force. A lot of conversation about testing as well. You can imagine, you know, some frustration from the governors that there's not more of the testing ingredients out there that you need. You know, the White House is saying you got a lot of capacity there, but we've got the razors, but we don't have the razor blades, if you can follow my analogy. And there, we're working hard to make sure that we're able to do more of, in particular, the PCR testing that tells you whether you're infected or not. And one good thing is the federal government is getting out of the way, and they're loosening the regulations for us, allowing the states to do be a little more entrepreneurial when it comes up to getting the swabs and it comes up with getting the reagents. And they've now said you can come up with your own swab and you can use cotton, American cotton if you want to, just like you have on a Q-tip. And opposed to some of the other liquids they use to transport, you can now use saline solution. Test that with Yale New Haven. Test that with UConn. Make sure it meets your protocols. But they're giving us a little more flexibility to be able to take the lead there. A final thought on testing. Well, I'll tell you, I thought I finally was able to figure out healthcare when the vice president was talking about, so this is going to be based upon IRR. And I said, as a business guy, great, an internal rate of return. No, IRR stands for the International Reagent Resources. They're the ones that's setting the standards by which a state like Connecticut with great healthcare labs and resources will be able to figure out how we can accelerate testing by coming up with our own reagents and transportation media. Abbott Labs, I was down there on Friday for the first day, and they are now doing hundreds, ramping up to 1,000 tests a day. This is going to be a big part of our testing future. I thanked, first of all, the head of CVS, because CVS is sponsoring this, saying, it's amazing what you're doing in New Haven. I'd like you to be able to provide a lot of this drive-through testing in other communities, starting in Hartford as soon as you can, since that's where the surge is. And I'll tell you, President Merlot gave you a real compliment. He said, we've set up a few of these around the country, and thanks to the Connecticut Guard, thanks to the Connecticut State Police, this went very smoothly. It was up within 72 hours. We're now doing the testing, and you're going to be a priority to expand. Of those tests, I was a little sad to see that, Caucasians tested positive about 8%. African-Americans tested positive about 35%. And we're going to do a much better job as we can to make sure that we have testing available for all of our people, especially those in the most diverse communities in our cities, and get them prompt attention to medical care, make sure that nobody is left behind there. Finally, with Vice President Pence, we also said, what are you going to do with all this testing? It's going to be followed by contact tracing, and make sure that once we find out somebody maybe is infected or liable to be infected, we can make sure we figure out who else they may be met with over a period of time. The CDC is sending thousands of contact tracers out right now. You know, to me, there may be some civil liberties issues there, and it seems very manually intensive for a state like Connecticut with 3.5 million people, not to mention New York. So we're also looking at other ways that we can do this, as well as people power. One, as you know, is that Apple and Google are coming out with their app. I think it's going to be within 3 to 4 weeks. So the president mentioned it some a month or so ago. And this will say for anybody who opts in, anybody who wants to be notified that they recently came into contact with somebody who was later found to be a COVID carrier, you'll be notified. And you'll know that you should at least self-quarantine going forward. Finally, with in the Vice President's call, we talked a lot about the business side of what's going on here and how we can provide support for people going forward. As you know, the Paycheck Protection Program, that was tapped out last week, and there's a real urgency to get another $250 billion. That's the money you need to help our small businesses power through for the next couple of months. David Layman gave us some relatively good news that, by no means did all of the companies that need it get it. We did have over 18,000 Connecticut small businesses get access to that money. That's about $4.2 billion in aggregate. So we did relatively well compared to some of our peer states out there. The supplemental, which is the next bill that will be coming out of the Senate, obviously the governors were pushing hard for $500 billion to help pay for state and local governments in terms of lost revenue. And I had an occasion to mention to the Vice President the two other things of importance to our state and all the other states. One is the unemployment compensation funds. Fortunately, we had put another $150 million into it over the last year and a half. So we were relatively well-funded, but by no means well-funded, by no means not enough to deal with this the level of unemployment claims that is hitting us, is that if you make that a loan to the states, which is what you traditionally do to true up that, that'll be a loan that's paid back by small business over the next years. And that's no way to dig out from under a recession. Make that a grant. And secondly, we're talking about a long-term loan to our state pension funds in general, those that are now underfunded in part thanks to the downturn in the stock market. And those are two things that the Vice President is going to be looking at as potentially part of our next supplemental. But let me take you back to howwefeel.org, because this is an amazing app that's going to put Connecticut at the very forefront in anticipation of more testing, being able to tell how people are doing, how they're feeling, and that's an early indicator of where our hotspots are. And first, I'd like to ask Feng Zheng to speak. He's a professor of neuroscience at MIT. He's been a leader here. We're so proud to be able to call you a partner and take the lead in making sure that how we feel is spread to, maybe hundreds of thousands of Connecticut residents taking the lead. Professor?
Hi. Governor, thank you very much for having me be a part of your press briefing. I'm from a project called How We Feel, and I, my day job is a professor at MIT, but since the beginning of the pandemic, my colleagues and I became very concerned about the virus and how quickly it is spreading through the community. We also recognized that there was a lack in testing capabilities, so we thought, can we come up with a different way to be able to track the spread of viruses? By talking with a number of colleagues and a number of concerned colleagues who want to volunteer to put together a new solution, we formed a nonprofit organization called the How We Feel Project. And through this project, we developed a mobile application called How We Feel, which is available through the Apple iOS store, the Android app store, as well as via the web, so that people can download this app, whether they're healthy or they are affected by COVID-like symptoms. They can provide information to help researchers and also policymakers better understand what is happening with the virus in their local community. Through this app and also through the web app, we ask individuals to contribute information, not their personal information, but only their zip code, as well as the symptoms and also a few other related information about how they are being affected by the ongoing pandemic. And through this information, we are generating models to be able to predict the emergence of new infection hotspots, to be able to get finer, more granular detail in terms of where the virus has spread to or where it's going to become an emerging hotspot, so that more information and more guidance can be provided to those regions to be able to better combat the virus. as the society continues to cope with this virus, and as we begin to grapple with the question of how do we reopen the economy, we're continuously evolving our app to be able to ask questions and learn more about how the community is being affected by the pandemic, where are the most challenging problems that that we need to solve, and then providing those information through the questions that we ask to policymakers and also researchers in public health and epidemiology, so that we can continue to best serve the general public to be able to overcome all of the devastations that this virus has brought us. And it's a great pleasure to be working with the state of Connecticut and the government of Connecticut, and we look forward to interacting on a regular basis, on a daily basis, with epidemiologists from the Department of Health to continuously monitor and also provide useful information to the people of the state of Connecticut. We have been collaborating with a large number of individuals, both experts in epidemiology from Harvard, from Yale, from UPenn, Cornell, University of Maryland, Stanford University, to be able to continuously analyze the data, glean, generate new insights about what is happening, and then provide the information back. And then we are also joined by other volunteers who are instrumental in developing the app, many software designers and app developers from Pinterest and also other companies, and also Ben Silverman, who is the founder of Pinterest, together both funding and also supporting this nonprofit initiative.